Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and on a week where Congress rose in one voice to sing happy birthday to a Holocaust survivor, and the president paid tribute to three World War II veterans, including a concentration camp liberator who sat next to one of the prisoners he helped to free, we're allowing firsthand accounts to clue us into some horrors of history that we all pray will never be repeated. Richard Morris passed away last week at the age of 94. But he lived the last 74 years with memories that haunted him because of what he encountered at the Dachau concentration camp as a 20-year-old. There was also something he experienced just after leaving Dachau that made him wonder. They had just settled in that same night when machine gun fire erupted in the darkness.
And I went to the half track, and a young buddy named Duffy from Brooklyn was on the half track, and he said, I just saw some German soldiers coming across the field. It was just clear enough that he could see them. Well, he said, halt, and they didn't halt, so he just started shooting, and a couple of them stood up and held their arms up, and we assumed the other three were killed. So anyway, two guys came forward, and one, I'm pretty convinced, was an SS officer. He'd taken off the insignia, but he had an SS officer's outfit on and everything. The other guy was an ordinary guard. The guard kept his hands up, and he kept shaking. He was shaking so bad, we told him and the officer to sit down on the ground. Both of them, we offered them some hot coffee and some cigarettes. The irony is, I think they thought we were going to kill them. Nobody had told us what to do with prisoners. And we didn't feel like killing them because we thought they suffered enough by being having their buddies killed. Anyway, I walked up to this officer, and I noticed a large hunk of his shoulder, his arm, about 3 inches before below the shoulder, had been cut out by a .50 caliber. And when it hits the flesh, it just cut a neat strip out of there. I looked at it, and I thought, that's amazing. That's flesh almost deep enough to go to his bone. I pointed it out to him, and he said, well, he just was ignoring the pain, I think. So I had him take his jacket off, and all of us had little first aid kits, which were a bandage and little packages of sulfur. So I sprinkled the sulfur on it and put the bandage around it. I think the lieutenant says, well, what are we going to do with these guys? And we had no place to put them on a half track. So by that, it was light enough, we could see another farmhouse down the road. And we said, just go on down there. The ladies will take care of you. And so we let them go. I honestly believe we might have been dealing with the guy who was in charge of the Dachau concentration camp. He seemed like a perfectly nice guy. He was, you know, overwhelmed by our kindness. And the guy whose arms were shaking never did stop shaking, but they both left and walked down the field.
And explain to us why you believe that. I mean, I'm sure it has to do with the fact that he was an SS officer and the proximity to the camp, because you're still pretty close to the concentration camp at this farmhouse, huh?
The logic of finding them there became clear to me as I thought about it. The Dachau concentration camp is north of Munich, and we were going south to get closer to Munich. And I think these guys and perhaps other officers from the camp went through a woods. And so by the morning we were at camp there, they start coming out of the woods. Those would be the only officers I could think of that would be in the area.
And because when you were in the camp, as you stumbled upon it, had never even heard of this idea of a concentration camp, didn't know what was being done to the Jews and those other political prisoners, you didn't see any officers there. All you saw was prisoners, right?
Exactly. And another thing, we had never been given much information about the clothing or the appearance of German soldiers and officers. I only learned this later when I did find out what German troops looked like and their officers. But the SS troops, as far as I was concerned, were the elite officer corps. And I think this man was in that rank. I'll never stop wondering, how come that feeling that we were going to be there to kill the German soldiers and win the war, how come we were not more angry at them? I think it was because we were all young and we all had not been. They never talked to us about what to do with dead bodies and with people that we might capture. They never talked to us about that, so we honestly didn't know what to do. That day we went into Munich, And Munich is the capital of Bavaria. And I learned later, Bavarians never really liked the Nazis, and they didn't like the Prussian attitude about fighting all the time. But they had to go along with it because Hitler had his forces were strong enough to stop anybody from disagreeing. But as we entered the city of Munich, people were putting their white sheets out of their windows and waving them at us to let us know they were happy and, you know, happy that we were coming and, in a sense, had saved them. Well, what else would you like to know? We're getting close to the end of my story.
We are, and I know some of it is easier to talk about than others, and I don't want to make you dwell on it, but it's been 70 years since that happened. It's been 70 years since all those concentration camps were liberated. And there are even people today who believe that it never happened, that these atrocities were not committed, that 6 million Jews and so many others were exterminated. But you saw it firsthand. So as painful as it might be to discuss, can you tell us what you saw, what kind of shape these human beings were in, and how devastating it was to witness all of that?
Yeah. I would say the whole scene and all of the men, and maybe there were about six that were actually in the crematorium working in there, and they looked like skin and bones. And as I think back about what I know about the Dachau concentration camp, they were the healthy ones. They were the ones that were expected to lift bodies, put them in the ovens. I learned later in the Dachau concentration camp, it was built in 38, right when Hitler started, and it was to be a prototype for other concentration camps. However, it didn't have a cellar where they gassed people. The camp was built for about 20,000 people. When it was liberated, it had about almost 40,000. For every barracks, let's say a barracks had 100 men. In every barracks where they had beds for 100 men, there would be 100 dead people also in those barracks. The Germans just let them lay there. Anyway, what that did to traumatize me, all my life I have had nightmares about somebody pulling me somewhere on my arm. And only recently did I begin to realize there's a connection with those guys pulling me into that crematorium to look at all that. It was sufficiently troublesome that I kept falling out of bed when I was sleeping with my wife, so I started sleeping on the floor rather than falling out of the bed. And I'm sure she thought it was because I didn't love her or something, and to me it was equally confusing. But up until recent years of my life, if I have a nightmare, that's the one that scares me. And in this house, I've fallen out of the bed several times, thinking I'm being pulled towards something I don't want to go to.
So you still get those nightmares 70 years later of people tugging on you and pulling you somewhere you don't want to go.
That kind of a reaction, I have learned, is a PTSD-type reaction. And that type of trauma cannot be dealt with by medicine alone. All you can do is kind of calm yourself down. And so that's what I've been doing. And the problem is, when you get out of the service, you don't talk to anybody, but I don't think I ever told anybody about the details of my experience in the crematorium.
We are thankful he shared it with us. And the same goes for Jim Sanders, who passed away in Modesto, California last year at the age of 93. He left behind a book written with Martha Leffler called Saving Lives, Saving Memories, a detailed account of his experiences as a 19-year-old ambulance driver who witnessed the concentration camp at Ohrdruf.
Someone ordered us to go down to this camp, one of the sub-camps of Buchenwald called Ohrdruf. Well, no one had told us about the concentration camp. We had no idea. So we drove down about 30 miles to this little town of Ohrdruf, you know, to find out, and they sort of, everybody knew where the camp was by then. And so we went up the hill through the gate with the big deal over the gate.
A big swastika?
Yeah. We pulled in, and all we saw were dead people. I mean, we'd seen dead and dying people, but these people, they were trying to get rid of. They were trying to burn the evidence, and they couldn't get it done. The ones that could still walk, they'd started to move them back to Buchenwald, walking. That day, that particular day, I don't know why, but we were there when Patton, Eisenhower, and Bradley drove, and Walton Walker, who was the 20th Corps commander, drove in their jeeps to see the place. And that was the day that Patton had the mayor and the people in town come up to see this place. And of course, they all knew it, but there wasn't anything they could do about it. And the mayor and his wife went home that day and committed suicide. And last year, I met the mayor, present mayor, and his wife of Ardriff when we were back there. And they're still trying to outlive that stigma of having the camp up on their hill of the town. And I don't know until all of us are gone, they're not going to get away from it.
Maybe they shouldn't either, because this is an important piece of history that needs to be remembered. When you talk about what you saw, and you mentioned the generals coming there and calling in the townspeople because they wanted to make sure that this wasn't glossed over in history, that it would be recorded, that there was evidence of it, that no one could explain it away, as some still try to do, amazingly enough, in parts of the world. Tell us about what you saw and what specifically struck you. I know it's not a pleasant thing to think about, but what was the most jarring thing for you to witness there?
You know, Martha Leffler, who no relation to you, but she's Jewish, of course, and she wanted more from us. She wanted more from Ray and I about what we talked about. But it was so mind-boggling. What could we? I've talked to Ray. I said, "What did we?" He said, "I can't remember that we talked about much of anything." And you know, it was just too much. Our vocabulary wouldn't cover it. You know, it was too much. And our only involvement in this, the whole thing from Buchenwald and Ardriff, was that we were with the ambulance and someone, we don't remember who, ordered us to pick up people that were lying in the fields. They couldn't, we assume, and we talked about it, we think they were the people that were moving from Ardriff back to the camp. Now, Ardriff was only one of the subcamps. There were about 80 subcamps around Buchenwald where they went to work. Now, Buchenwald itself was not a killing camp per se. It was not a gas camp. They died, thousands died, but the malnutrition, beatings, whatever. But they were asked us to pick up people that were lying in the fields. And we didn't know what they were. They were little striped pajamas with little patches, and we could put two on a litter. Can you imagine that? One's head up here, one's head down there. And we carried DDT in cans at that time. DDT, which has been banned, but they're using it again down in Africa. The malaria is worse than the DDT. We'd sprinkle DDT all over them. They're worried about typhus, and we'd sprinkle it on ourselves and all over the ambulance. And so I'm 86 and still here, so the DDT didn't get me. But anyway, we made two or three loads, and then we went on to finish the war. And we kept going, and that's about the time we heard that President Roosevelt had died. So we were in a field somewhere, and a half-track had a radio and announced that President. We didn't carry radios. So we went on to finish the war then.
I need to ask, when you look back on that, and I know that you were back at Buchenwald for the 65th anniversary of the liberation, you've taken your family back to some of these places. When you think about what happened there, the way that human beings were treated there, why, in your mind, is it important to preserve that history and to remind people of what happened there? Why do you go back for an anniversary there? Why is that important to you?
You know, it is interesting, because we thought that was going to all end, but it didn't. Mankind cannot seem to get along on this beautiful spaceship we have. They can't take care of it. When mankind came out of the cave and he saw somebody else and he picked up a rock, he threw it at him. And every piece of equipment that he ever designed to hurt someone or kill someone, he's used. And we used the big bomb in 1945, and somebody will use it again. I'm just real worried about that. Those Germans are still trying to live down this thing of the Holocaust. They're still trying to live it down all these years later. And the only time they'll be able to get rid of it is when we're all gone. And we're leaving at the rate veterans of World War II are leaving. So, you know, we have not much. If you don't believe that, just take a look at your local paper and you'll see that World War II, three or four are dying every day in your local paper. Think about all the local papers around the United States.
You're preaching to the choir, because that's why this show is here, to preserve these stories, and that's what your book has done, to preserve some of these stories so it won't be forgotten. You've had the chance to go back and take your children and grandchildren, and I understand that you visited a cemetery at Normandy, pointed out a certain grave to them, and had a certain message to share with them. Tell me about that.
Yes, we knew a lady in Turlock whose brother was there. He was, I think he was maybe 20. And so they have a quite good registry there at the cemetery above Omaha Beach. And so we went, found his grave, and they were all standing around it. And I said, now, you see this young man, you know, that could have been me, and that would mean that you wouldn't be here. Wouldn't have had 4 days in Paris and 4 days out in this nice countryside. So, yeah, I think that they'll remember that. And part of the reason I wrote the book was because of the Holocaust deniers, too. As long as I'm alive, these eyes still remember it. It's still up here in the computer, this brain called a computer. It's still there. I can still see it today. I got to tell you one quick story here. This man I met, his name is Charles Payne. And I was talking to him, and he said he was in 89th Division as he came through, and he was a PFC. And he was rode in a Jeep as he came through. And I said, well, I was an ambulance driver here, and I was a PFC. We were all PFCs, ambulance drivers. And I said, Charles Payne, now I've heard that name. He said, yeah, he said, he was rather shy about it, but he said Obama was his nephew. He was the great uncle, and his sister was the grandmother that took care of Obama. So I mailed him two books. I sent one to Charles, and I made the other one out to President Obama, and I told Charles, I said, now, when you see your nephew, give him this book. He'll learn something about World War II. I don't know whether he ever got it. Charles got the book. You know? I talked to Charles later, and he said, I liked your book, but I haven't seen my nephew yet.
Well, we heard from our 45th president earlier in the program, and maybe by now our 44th president has read the late Jim Sanders book, too. That book is linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and we're not done yet. When we come back, he grew up in Germany, escaped the Holocaust by securing passage to America, and eventually went back to fight the Nazis. If you're a man over 50, you may have also benefited from some of his scientific exploits as well. We're going to explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.